Okay, so thanks for being here still on Friday. Maybe you should all check your flights, by the way. Maybe you have to be here even longer than you expected. So let me start with the motivation and strategy. So this workshop was mostly about 2+1D TQFTs. We had KitHive models. We didn't have so much string nets, but they are also defined in 2+1. Hopf algebra gauge theories, and these also needed a 2D structure. And the question is, can we somehow elegantly derive from these 3+1D theories, and what would be these 3+1D theories? And the answer is yes. And what we will do, so I'm sometimes, no, I need to do calculations sometimes, so I'm really interested in having explicit Hilbert space realizations and operators and so on. And this Hilbert space, sometimes Robert called it code space. And we can take these things in 2+1 and lift them to Hilbert spaces and code spaces and operators and 3+1. And here you can also define something which would be Hamiltonians. I might not mention that too much in the talk, but in principle you can do that. And so with these Hamiltonians, you actually do get a 3+1 TQFTs with line defects. for instance, if you do take like string nets, you get improved. Something which I would see actually a more consistent definition of the Walker-Wong model or Krein-Jetter model with line defects. But it's also possible to introduce generalizations. And we learn a lot about actually also the geometric interpretations and phase space interpretations of these operators. And I was interested in that coming from quantum gravity, so there are a number of strong motivations in this construction from quantum gravity, which I might not mention too much. So basically, what happens is that if you want to introduce a cosmological constant, we know that in 2+1 we can do that with a quantum deformation of SU2, so then we get an SU2k as for a positive cosmological constant. And in this case, braiding plays a strong role. You need it all the time. And so the question, braiding is something which can be easily defined in 2D. The question was to use the structure also in 3D, again, without kind of using projections, which I didn't find very consistent sometimes. okay, so this is the motivation. Here's a strategy. The strategy involves a bit of topology. And so if you have never seen that, here is some easy example. So what does a 2+1D TQFT do? Or we basically consider these classes of 2+1D TQFTs, which do the following. You have your surface, so which corresponds to your equal time surface. And on this surface, you define a Hilbert space. But this Hilbert space will carry a basis with kind of fundamental degrees of freedom. And these degrees of freedom will be associated to non-contractible loops. So to this loop, but not to this loop. So here, of course, the topology plays an important role. And as we have seen for the KitHive model, okay, if you have this non-contractible loop, you know, that means you do have some operators or some degrees of freedom associated to it. And in some sense, you can actually, in geometric terms, you do get a curvature of your holonomy there if it's a gauge theory. So that means that curvature would be concentrated somehow inside this torus if you see it from this way. so the idea is indeed to also use a surface in your 3D theory. And in fact, there's a topological construction, which is called Hegart splitting. And here it comes with a Hegart surface. So the point is that you can get these Hegart surfaces and Hegart splittings always from a triangulation. And we have seen that basically, if you have a non-contractible loop, there will be some degree of freedom associated to this non-contractible loop. So in fact, this triangulation in the end, we will allow that the edges of the triangulation will carry non-trivial degrees of freedom. And in a gravitational context, these will basically carry curvature defects. And that's basically actually what happens in gravity exactly. So what we consider here is a triangulation of your 3D space. I have taken a triangulation of the 3 sphere with 2 tetrahedra. So what you do, you actually identify these 2 tetrahedra completely to each other, like what you could do also in 2D. If you have 2 triangles, you glue them together at the edges. This defines you a triangulation of the sphere. So I just took a tetrahedra because it's kind of one of the simplest examples. Then what you do have is two kinds of curves on the surface. So you take this triangulation, the edges, or the one skeleton of this triangulation, you blow it up a bit, and you consider the surface of this second one skeleton, and you have two kinds of curves. You have curves which go around the edges, and this is, you know, this is these curves we want to allow to have non-trivial data, because we want to allow these defects or curvature defects on these edges of the triangulation. But we have also curves which actually go around the boundary of triangles here, of this triangle of the triangulation. And these would be curves which are non-contractible on the surface, but we want to basically treat them as contractible because they can be contracted in the outside of this three sphere. So what we can do is basically take the Hilbert space associated to the surface, but we have to put projections or constraints which make sure that these blue curves, which will not be assigned with non-trivial degrees of freedom. Okay, that's the entire idea. And it works for general lattice and the general triangulation, and that it works is basically ensured by the theory of Hegart splittings and Hegart diagrams. So in general, you can take any compact 3D manifold, also with non-trivial topology. So here I took a 3 sphere, which of course has a trivial topology. And this Hegart splitting says the following. So this compact orientable bar 3D manifold, you can split into two parts, so-called Hendel bodies. And here you see examples of Hendel bodies. So actually, it's balls glued together via tubes. That is actually the example with the tetrahedron. So we have one Hendel body here for the sphere, which comes from the triangulation with two tetrahedra. And the other Hendel body, the second one, it's depicted here. It's actually based on the dual graph of the triangulation, which would have one vertex inside this tetrahedron, one outside. And then for every triangle here, you have one edge connecting these two vertices. So here you have an inside tetrahedron, here you have an outside tetrahedron, the four edges, and everything is basically just blown up. And if you do an hard exercise and imagination, you can kind of glue these two things together and get this free sphere. And these two surfaces are basically the same. Have at least the same genus, and that actually means topologically they are of course the same. So this defines the Hegart surface. What you need in addition is basically a basis, a generating basis for these curves. So you will have what is called one Hendel cycle, or we'll call it edge cycle or E cycle, which are contractible in one Hendel body. And these curves around the triangles, which we want to keep trivial, I will call T cycles, and they're contractible in Hendel body two. here you see this blue curve would go around one of these edges, and you can contract that inside this Hendel body. But here it would go around here, and that you cannot contract inside this handle body. So the point is that the Heger diagram then encodes basically the entire topology and more of your 3D topology. And that's what we were going to use. So as I mentioned, they can be constructed from a triangulation of the 3D manifold. There's, of course, more general Heger diagrams than coming from a triangulation. And the set of cycles around triangles generate indeed all curves that are contractible in the outside of the one skeleton of the triangulation. So if you want to really make ensure that all these blue curves don't carry degrees of freedom, it's sufficient to impose these projectors or constraints for the triangles of the triangulation. Okay. So I will discuss two examples, I hope. So the strategy, as I mentioned, is we take the Hilbert space operators and bases for a given theory, for a given topological theory. For a closed surface, we will apply that to the Heger surface. And all we have to do is to impose these constraints and projectors to consider which states are basically consistent with these constraints and which operators are consistent with these constraints. And we will get basically our Hilbert space and operators for the 3 plus 1 theory. So let's consider an example which actually technically is actually more difficult to calculate with, but is maybe easier to understand if you know what a gauge theory is. So that would be what we call BF theory. It's basically also the Kitaev model or string nets with a fusion category, the representations of a group, which is non-modular. So here, if you come from, say, the gauge theory perspective, and it would be the same in all these cases with the Kitaev model and the string nets. So now I'm going to discuss an even simpler example. Namely, let's assume the Heger surface is a torus, and what we get is basically a theory in 3 plus 1, that is in 3D, and we will allow a line defect which sits inside this torus. Okay, so we will get basically a loop excitation in the end, and that's the simplest case. But we will already see all important effects happening here. So if you consider the space of flat connections, which is basically BF theory, or the Kitaev model we have seen quite a lot, so the toric code, you have for the torus these two cycles, which carry non-trivial degrees of freedom. And in principle, you have these two group elements which label the cycle, but which give you basically it's called holonomies for this torus, so the degrees of freedom here. But what you have to make sure of is that actually you have really a flat connection, and this gives you a kind of global constraints on these two group elements. Namely, that the commutator of these two group elements is trivial. It's a little e here. And furthermore, you want to consider wave functions, which are gauge invariant. So I have just written that here you have also the condition that this is a gauge invariant wave function, and the gauge invariance the gauge group action would be at this vertex. So the point is that you know, for the abelian case, it would be for the abelian toric code, you indeed have just these two group elements which define your basis. For this model, for the non-abelian group case, these two group elements are a complete overparametrization. First of all, you have this condition, and then you have gauge invariance. So you can ask, what would define you an orthonormal basis in this space? And the answer is somewhat non-trivial, because it's given by one of the structures we discussed here. Basically, the representation of the Drinfeld double of the group G. So now, you know, I'm not going to explain what that is, but let me just mention that the label here, which would label then one basis, so ignore the second ribbon here, would comes with a conjugacy class of one group element. So this would be the conjugacy class of G2. And the conjugacy class is a gauge invariant object, or is invariant under conjugation. That's how the gauge transformations would act. But then the second label is something more involved. So you take this conjugacy class, it comes with a group theoretical object, namely the stabilizer group, and you take an irreducible representation of the stabilizer group. And in fact, what these two labels tell you, they do give you the eigenvalues of a certain operator, or you can basically define projective Rippon operators. Again, these are basically things which have been defined by Kitaev. And in gauge theoretic terms, this Rippon operator measures the solonomy or the conjugacy class of the solonomy around this loop. And this other data is actually the conjugated operator, which is this kind of electric flux operator along this loop. And it means actually that it will change this group element, because the conjugated thing will change the value of this group element. if you're used to spinning particles, actually these two labels give you the mass of the particle, and here is some other thing, which is a curvature, which the conical defect which this point particle would get, and this R label is actually the spin of the particle. Okay, so in this sense, so these labels define your basis of your Hilbert space. You can also take the transversal Rippon operator here, and basically that's, you already see a bit that this will be some kind of Fourier transform. In fact, that's known as an S matrix, but we will recover its interpretation as a Fourier transform. Okay. So if we want to now interpret that in 3 plus 1 as a Hilbert space in 3D, but with allowing basically a line defect along the center of this torus here, so this would be the defect loop. So then we can have, you know, encircling this defect loop is this bound loop, which would be non-contractible, so that can be a non-trivial holonomy. And along this defect loop, we will have a blue curve. So here we would impose that this can not carry a non-trivial holonomy, so we would impose that this is kind of a trivial holonomy. Again, that is simple to say here. If you go to this Drinfeld double basis, it's easy to impose in one case, namely in this case where rho is indeed the Rippon is going around also the same direction here. And then we have seen that this conjugacy class gives us the holonomy around here. So flatness just means that this conjugacy class is trivial. In this case, the stabilizer group is the entire group, so we get that R is an irreducible representation of the group G. And in fact, we get just what is known as spin network basis. So we get one loop here, which is labeled by a representation of the group, and that defines a spin network basis for this case. We can take the other basis. In this case, it's a bit more involved. So now this C is arbitrary, because this just gives you the defect excitation which sits on this defect. It's giving you the holonomy of this Brown loop. So that can be an arbitrary value. But R is not just one level, but you need to take these basis states and sum over the R label for each given conjugacy class. And actually that, because you have C here, that gives you the curvature basis. And it can also be defined in general. It gives you a new gauge invariant basis in 4D. So it will result in a gauge invariant basis. So then you have basically the transformation between these two states. It's not exactly the S matrix, because the full S matrix would not be invertible. But it's in you restrict the S matrix because here you have a trivial conjugacy class, and that basically defines your group Fourier transform, a gauge invariant version of the group Fourier transform. That is just the transformation between these two bases. So in general, you can do that for any triangulation. And you get a complicated Taggart surface for a very complicated triangulation, of course. But for these, even for these cases of high genus surfaces, you can give a basis, which is sometimes referred to as fusion basis, which again would be just labeled by these Drinfeld double representations. And we have seen that if we adjust this to the triangulation, we get the curvature basis, at least for trivial topology of the 3D manifold. So there's more non-trivial things happening if you have a non-trivial topology, because you have ground state degeneracy in this case. If you adjust this choice of basis to a second dual graph, you get the spin network basis. So this adjusted just means this choice of how you orient this ribbon in the case I shown you in these. In general, there are much more general basises, which give you indeed also kind of mixed cases between these things in 3+1. We can consider the Kitaev ribbon operators along the E cycles. So these would be just in this gauge theory interpretation be Wilson loops or magnetic Wilson loops. And so these would be quite simple operators. The nice thing is also that ribbon operators along T cycles. So here you need to also restrict a bit the labels of these ribbon operators because not all are consistent with the flatness constraint. But in this case, a ribbon operator along the T cycle gives you actually the electric surface, a surface operator, which is, in gauge theory is also known as the Toft operator. And the surface operator is glued together by the triangles you surround with your ribbon operator, basically. okay, so that tells you that in principle, you can take your 2+1 ingredients, and they give you interesting things in 3+1. And here, I think even from the 3+1 theory, I mean, at least I wasn't aware of that one can construct this curvature basis. And actually, the non-trivial fact is that this is indeed a complete basis for the 3-sphere. And that the Fourier transform you basically in this simple example comes from the S matrix. In more complicated examples, it's combinations of S matrices and F transformations. So this is if we really want to get basically the theory, which would be actually 3+1 BF theory for a group. But with curvature or with magnetic defects along the edges of a graph or in this case of a triangulation. We can, however, consider generalizations. We have seen we had this Hilbert space and then we imposed projectors. And of course there was a condition that these projectors are commuting or form an algebra. In fact, they are commuting, so that you can all impose them. And they're also gauge invariant. And we could also go on and actually kind of consider other projectors or not consider the projectors at all, and you get also a Hilbert space and then you get also operators. The question I have, I mean, there's some ideas around what is the interpretation in 3+1 terms. So there's actually a construction which I will mention later also in fusion categories, which is motivated by work by Barrett and Behrens defining non-trivial 4D TQFTs. So we had line defects along the triangulations, but you can also now think about line defects along the dual of the triangulation and having both of these defects. So what in this case, what you could do is to weaken these triangle constraints, which we basically say to holonomies around these blue cycles around the triangles have to be trivial. You can also allow them to take values in a normal subgroup of your group. So there are two extreme cases, namely the identity, which gives you back the previous thing, and the full group, which gives you something, I think, the biggest Hilbert space. But if you have a normal subgroup, you can do that. You have to choose a normal subgroup to get each invariance. And in this case, these eigenvalues of the holonomy, of course, can take some values. So you would get degrees of freedom associated to the triangles. But if you think in terms of holonomies, they would really be some, you know, topologically, you should associate them to the dual graph of your triangulation. So you would have these two structures carrying both degrees of freedom at the same time. And in this case, they're not completely free of each other, because we have seen in the Drinfeld case, one label is the conjugacy class, and then what happens is that this restricts the second label, which is this irrep of the normal, of the stabilizer group. So if you have actually non-trivial excitation here on the triangle, it will reduce, it will change the group with respect to which you take the representations. So you modify your spin network labels in this case. So I haven't looked at it in detail, but I mean, one question is what would be the interpretation of that? Either in condensed matter or in geometric terms. Okay, are there questions to that? Because to this case? I'm going to the next example, which is a priori looks more complicated, but structurally is simpler, because now we have a modular fusion category, and the Drinfeld double of a modular fusion category is quite simple. And you can kind of guess what to expect. So if you consider the say string nets, or what Robert described as Tourev-Virou code space, so it would be basically the Hilbert space belonging to the Tourev-Virou TQFT, then you also have something which you can call ribbon operators, or a basis. And in fact, the basis and these ribbon operators are labeled by basically the excitations which you can have here, or for torus it would give you exactly the Drinfeld center, an object of the Drinfeld center of your fusion category, assumed to be modular. So I will label objects of my fusion category by J, because I'm used to do SU2K, and then we call it always J. And these little indices mean overcrossing and undercrossing. You might see in a minute what that means. okay, so these give us the basis in this case. So we also have these two bases and an S transformation acting between these. Now we want to impose a constraint or projector. And basically, we have seen in the group case, what happens is we trivialize always one copy of one entry of our Drinfeld double of the group. Here it's even simpler. We will indeed just trivialize one of the copies of the double. And we can choose again either this direction or this direction for the ribbon. And these two different cases give us the spin network basis, so quantum deformed, which gives you basically the structure which appears in the definition of the Walker-Wang model. Or here is one advantage. You also get a dual basis, so it's a curvature basis, which immediately diagonalizes the Walker-Wang Hamiltonian. So here, if you have a more general triangulation, you will get a higher genus surface. It's also known, maybe Robert mentioned that or not, what kind of basis you have there. So roughly, it's also a graph, or this in this case is a skeleton for the Segard surface. And the skeleton is labeled by again, this, each edge is labeled by these two spin labels, which define you an object in this Drinfeld center. here we've seen we trivialize one copy, so that will also appear in the more general case, so we will trivialize one copy, and that happens in both, completely in both the curvature basis and the spin network basis, so there's no problem with non-trivial 3D topologies. And this gives you actually basis for the Witten-Reshetnikin-Turev TQ of T, which you can see as a quantization of Chern-Simons. And indeed, that's what one should expect if you consider the classical phase space. And for instance, Aldo has a recent paper about that. If you consider quantum deformed 3 plus 1 lattice Young-Mills theory, the Hilbert space can be expressed as the phase space can be expressed as a phase space of 2 plus 1 Chern-Simons theory on the Hegart surface, which belongs to the lattice here. So that's completely consistent with the classical theory. okay, let me check. Yeah, I could. So here, in the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes, I will basically give you more details, which I will kind of go fast through the basic, through the 2 plus 1 basics. And these things have been mentioned by Robert in his talk. so this would be basically what he calls the Turev-Virov code space for, in this case, I will consider just the torus. So for a surface without punctures, because it shows that actually the calculations you have to do in the end are much simpler than what we usually have to do in, for instance, the group case, or even in my case in quantum gravity. So in general, this is basically also describing string nets on the surface. So the string nets, you can choose an arbitrary graph embedded in your surface, and it's labeled by the objects of your fusion category, in this case, just spins of SU2K. And at the vertices, you need to have the coupling rule satisfied for these spins. Here we consider only 3-valent vertices, but this is just a technical thing. You can also treat higher valent vertices. now we know that there's kind of a non-trivial dynamics or a topological dynamics for 2 plus 1 D to Reviro. And this will be imposed by equivalence relations on all these states. And one, the simplest one is that you can deform all the edges of your graph on your surface. Zero, so the trivial object in your fusion category doesn't matter. You can just omit these graphs. And here you see a bit the topological nature coming in, because you impose kind of triangulation invariance of the dual triangulation to this graph. One is that you can have change your graph by this 2-2 partner move, and the other is this 3-1 partner move. And then the coupling symbol or the F symbol or the associator is appearing here. So basically now, you have defined your theory as a big Hilbert space modulo these equivalence relations, and the problem is usually that you have to find an independent basis consistent with these equivalence relations, and operators which are consistent with these relations, and it's all a beautiful theory, which I'm not going too much into it. What happens is that the braiding structure in this case makes, and the modularity structure in this case makes it quite easy to write them in diagrammatic notation. So what you now also you need to use is basically the possibility to have 4-valent vertices with the braiding, which you can resolve into 3-valent vertices using the R matrix. That allows you to define basically the S matrix as the evaluation of the Hopf link. What I didn't add it here is that all such kind of graphs which are planar So it can be evaluated by to a number by using the previous equivalence relations. So by using these equivalence relations and using that, for instance, the zero spin can be omitted. This just defines you the number and this for these different spins, and this range of numbers defines you some version of the S matrix. A very important identity, which you can again show explicitly by using these equivalence relations, is that one strand encircling another strand gives you again something related to the S matrix. It's just this long strand. And the other concept we need is vacuum strands. Sometimes they are also called omega. And in fact, these vacuum strands, which are defined as a just sum over all representations, if you remember what the delta function looked like expressed in characters, it's something like a flatness condition. And that's why it's called a vacuum strand. And these vacuum strands indeed make every object inside their whatever they encircle, in some sense, invisible to the outside strands. So you can always move outside strands along the vacuum lines across these circles. And another property, which again can be proven by this graphical, by these equivalence relations, is that a strand, if it's encircled by a vacuum line, is projected to the zero, to the trivial object. Okay, and you see that all these objects like braiding and the vacuum strand indeed appear as for the basis, really, for the explicit basis. So we will have that the basis is parametrized by these two spins. So this gives us, since it's two spins, the Drinfeld center. And explicitly, we have a vacuum loop along one cycle of the torus, and these overcrossing and undercrossing loops labeled by these spins along the other cycle. And of course, we can kind of do an S transformation and get this other basis here. Again, that's what I really showed. You can define a Hilbert space and a basis for general genus surfaces, which is based on a Pant decomposition. And this Pant decomposition will define you a set of loops along which you cut the surface into Pants. Along all these loops, you put a vacuum line, and then you have a dual graph to that, which will be labeled, the edges will be labeled again by these two copies of spins. So the ribbon operators in this case are actually quite simple again. A ribbon operator is just, you know, has two sides, and that will be just an overcrossing and undercrossing Wilson loop. And so again, it will be labeled by two spins, so again, the Drinfeld center. And it's also easy to explicitly diagonalize these ribbon operators, at least in the basis. Here we see if you have a vacuum loop, and now you see how useful this sliding property is. And we have a Wilson loop around this vacuum loop. We can slide this Wilson loop along this, I mean, across this circle of the vacuum loop. And if you do that with this undercrossing and overcrossing copy, but you have these other spins going in between all these other things, they will just end up to encircle these strands. And these will just give S matrices. So here, what you see two things. One is that the overcrossing and the undercrossing copy completely decouple. They don't talk to each other in this case. So here you have only overcrossing, overcrossing, undercrossing, undercrossing. And we can easily diagonalize all our ribbon operators in a given basis. Okay, so we have now discussed the Hilbert space and the operators. So all we have to do is to impose the constraint, and again I do that for the simplest example. And now it's again super easy to see. So we had our basis here. I have to make a choice. I say the flatness constraint. We have seen that the vacuum loop is imposing something like the delta function. So we say we impose this overcrossing Wilson loop on this basis. What will happen is it will just kill the overcrossing copy, graph copy. And it's the same argument we had before. So for this basis, we can slide this red vacuum loop across the black vacuum loop, and we end up with this red vacuum loop encircling this overcrossing strand. And we use the killing property I had at some point, and that will basically force this spin to be zero. And so we are left just with the undercrossing strand here. So that's this case where we are just left with this one spin. Indeed, that will define as the equivalent of a spin network basis, which is based on a graph dual to the curvature defects. So it indeed sits on the dual of the triangulation. And you can also consider the other case. Again, it will be more involved because what happens is that in this case, the overcrossing graph here is not forced to be trivial, but is forced to be a vacuum loop. So it's a sum over labels. So this will give us a curvature basis. It's again just labeled by the object in the fusion category. And it's based on a graph along the curvature defects. So these labels will sit on the edges of the triangulation. And in between, we have a quantum group Fourier transform, which indeed is here just given by the S matrix. and that will diagonalize these certain Wilson loop under operators, namely the ones around the equator, so that is along the triangles, and in fact, and geometrically, they will measure the area of the surface bent by the curvature defect. And here they diagonalize the Wilson loop around the curvature defect, and so they will indeed measure the curvature of this curvature defect. And actually, so here the difference is that the curvature basis in this case can be easily defined even in, for general topologies of your 3D surface. So it will be basically just a graph along the triangulation or lattice. You in principle have these vacuum loops around these edges. And these edges of the graph will be labeled by the objects of your fusion category. And as before, you have coupling rules associated to the vertices here. So this is where you could actually define a Hamiltonian for this model, which would basically impose zero curvature associated to all the curvature defects. And we are in the curvature basis, so we can, this basis already diagonalizes this Hamiltonian and defines a vacuum state. And this vacuum state is actually the vacuum state which in the gravitational context comes from Kreh-Netta TQFT, which indeed as a TQFT is a trivial TQFT. And here just this vacuum state would be trivial spins associated to all these edges. And my claim that this works for all topologies means that indeed we have a non-degenerate vacuum state for all topologies. It depends on some claims about the Hegart surface, and otherwise it's easy to see. And if you go back to some old papers, I found here a rather inconsistent argument for finding that it's actually non-degenerate, because they find a vacuum state which is not the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. But it had something to do that indeed in the Walker-Wang model you usually don't have these vacuum loops, and they are kind of important for doing things. Okay, that's what I said before. You have these operators for the 3+1 theory, and usually you have Wilson loops and fluxes, And they act quite differently. In standard lattice gate theory, they are also labeled in two different things, namely the group and the Lie algebra. What happens here, you place the Lie algebra almost by the group, and then everything gets a bit more involved, and both things are compact. And in fact, now, so again, that's related to also work by Aldo and Franz. Now both operators, both the flux and the Wilson loop, are both imposed as really Wilson loops, but around different kinds of cycles, namely these edge cycles and the T cycles correspondingly. And again, from a quantum gravity perspective, or physically, it means that these two operators, which a priori are quite different, are exactly the same, and they will end up to have exactly the same spectrum, which is here. And the spectrum, yeah, it's discrete. We are always happy about that. In quantum gravity, it's also bounded. So as opposed to different frameworks, everything is completely finite dimensional. And we have an interesting duality between configuration space and momentum space in this case. In fact, that corresponds to having geometries which are piecewise homogeneously curved. and so in this case, you have a sphere, like the phase space is really a sphere across a sphere. So I'm almost, yeah. So I considered the torus mostly. Of course, you can go to more complicated topologies. So here would be a four-simplex, and it's a quantum state, and then it's also quantum deformed, so it's a quantum four-simplex. And triangulation of the four-simplex would be basically a graph with 5 vertices and 10 edges, and you have blown it up. The dual graph for this is, again, the same thing. So basically, this picture almost gives you both the curvature basis and the spin network basis, just that in one case, there are more vacuum loops which are suppressed. So this is actually the spin network basis for the four simplex. And the Walker-Wang model is defined on a cubical lattice. So you can basically consider a 3 torus. And then I suppress here all vacuum loops because it would be hard to draw. And you can basically choose any kind of splitting of a graph on the surface into 3 valent nodes. And that would define you basically the cubical lattice. And as I said, here you have both bases, and you have also all operators consistent with this structure. So then basically if you have simplices, you can ask what is the Kreh-Netter amplitude. So that, and I told you that this would be kind of the vacuum state for Kreh-Netter. And in fact, so this is just a state. This is just another spin network basis. So if you put all labels to 0, that is basically a vacuum state in the curvature basis. And you get this Kreh-Netter amplitude, the simplex amplitude for your TQFT by expanding the state in your spin network basis. So let me mention the last point, and that's generalizations which come from work by John Barrett and Manuel Behrens. And here, I told you before, in the group case, we kind of weakened the constraints. And they had the idea they wanted to define non-trivial TQFTs, and that's what they did. And actually, it also was an inspiration for this work. This construction is also based on a topological construction, a Hendel decomposition of your four manifold. And in this case, you also just have more or less one Hendels and two Hendels, which define the entire topology of your four manifold. So it's all higher dimensional, so it's known as Kirby calculus, but it doesn't matter. And what we have seen, if you do Kreh-Netter, then we have vacuum loops around the triangles, and we will have 0 here, but it basically means we, in principle, have also vacuum loops around the edges. And the idea was so we treat one handles and two handles the same. Here the idea is to treat the one handles and two handles differently. So you start with also a fusion category, in this case spherical, but then to color basically your two handles, you choose basically something like a subcategory, just that this is not so well defined. So I think this is D here. And you label basically the two handles by the vacuum loop of the subcategory. And this defines you basically not the Krenyetta, but really a modification of that. And choosing the right ingredients, you will get a non-trivial 4D TQFT. So again, what you could do in this case, in this framework here, you could basically impose constraints. You can use the same inputs and impose, instead of these vacuum loops of the full category, a vacuum loop of some different category. Okay, so that's, of course, much better explained in this paper, which brings me to the conclusions. So what we have here is a general technique to lift Hilbert spaces and operators for 2+1 D TQFTs to 3+1 series. We have seen we get line defects. and we discussed in more detail Tour-Reviro for a modular fusion category. In this case, you get a Krenyetta with curvature defects and BF theory or Tour-Reviro for representation of the groups. In this case, you get 4D BF theory with curvature defects. There's a lot of open questions. I mean, as the last points were basically, here you have line defects along the triangulations, but you could introduce a second class of line defects, which would be along the dual of the graph, and which might be even labeled by a different category or subgroup in the group case. And what we got is a straightforward analysis of excitations and operators for the 3+1 theory, because we could use all the well-developed techniques in 2+1. and what we are actually working on is also to generalize a fusion basis, which is very well developed in 2+1 to 3+1, which actually will include some interesting insights into Lattice-Young-Mills theory. So here it's a number of things one can do in the future. So that would be look in more detail and basically taking these covariant or 4D models of Behrens and Behret and analyze them in Hilbert space and add defects. So that was an open question. And I've only spoken about line defect has a particular reason. In principle, one could also add the same kind of defects, point defects you have in the Walker-Wang model, just that I don't have a natural interpretation in this context yet. one can start still with other models in the 2+1 theory, indeed, which geometrically impose different kind of defects. So for instance, Dijkerre-Fitton can impose torsion defects instead of curvature defects. And another big question for me is to consider boundaries and boundary excitations, which again you can do, which has been done for the Walker-Wang model. So I can do it ad hoc basically. But the question is a natural framework using these Heegaard surfaces or Heegaard decompositions. Okay, so thank you. Well, it's a good question because we don't know all all 4D TQFTs.
No.
You could say that this thing which was motivated by John Barrett and Manuel Behrens is one example where you have to do something in addition. So we can speculate, is that, you know, part of the lifting or generalized lifting procedure? But if I would do the kind of simple procedure, I only get Crenietta or only get BF. I think I can get more, for instance, if I consider this theory which has torsion defects, as is like a fitten, then it's also a question what I get there and 3 plus 1, which is not the question which TQFT, but which kind of line defects I do get. And then it seems that to get these models of Barrett and Behrens or these dichromatic models, you at least have to change these constraints. So, but still there is this big Hilbert space, and all what we do here is to project down with different projectors. So to classify, you know, what do you get there, and do you get all 4D TQFTs? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's also a question, do you get all local TQFTs? Because these examples by Barrett and Behrens, a large class of them, it's not very clear whether they can write them locally or not. I mean, their construction is not a local construction. And they give conditions under which they know to rewrite them as local states or models. But yeah. So there seems to be even two notions of locality, because I do get something like a kind of local Hilbert space, maybe even for models which you cannot write as local state sum models. I don't know. There's more things to consider, but it's fresh work, so there are much more things to think about concerning classification.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank you again.